in that crash. So I want to know why you aren't angry at the manufacturer. I want to know why you won't cut yourself a break.
All the air in my lungs comes out in a massive rush, leaving me feeling deflated and lost. I don't have an answer to her question.
Have you heard of survivor's guilt?
She asks quietly. Sure, I admit. I mean, who hasn't? But it is the first time I've considered that term in conjunction with myself. Nora smiles gently, her voice soothing.
It's a very normal response to loss, and while you are dealing with other issues in your grief, it's sort of where I'd like to focus our attention to start.
You mean I need to learn how to forgive myself? I mutter bitterly, my gaze going down to my clasped hands.
No,
she replies swiftly, and my head pops up.
You have nothing to forgive yourself for. You were absolved in that crash.
Yes, I know that, I say with frustration, sitting up straighter. I read the report dozens of times. Intellectually, I know that. So why the fuck do I still feel so terrible about it?
There's no real logic to it. Unfortunately, guilt isn't an emotion that's easy to get control of,
she replies. Then how do you get past it? I ask. Actually, it almost seems like I'm begging her for the answer, because one thing Nora has managed to do since she told me about what happened to her is give me a small sliver of hope that perhaps I can move past these wretched feelings.
There are a few things to help you cope,
she says evenly.
But it's work. You have to work at it every day, and it won't be easy.
Like what? I demand.
You need time to grieve,
she replies, shifting forward a bit as if we're sharing secret information.
When you start feeling like it's your fault, you need to redirect your focus to who was really responsible. You need to be kind to yourself, Tacker. Take care of yourself. Remind yourself you are not alone in this because you have people who care about you and support you.
That seems like some of your hippy-dippy shit, I mutter. Luckily, Nora's not offended. She actually chuckles.
There are a few other things, ones you might not like.
Such as?
Sharing your feelings,
she answers with a hard look.
That means here in our counseling sessions, you need to be open and honest. Lean on friends and family. Let them know how this has affected you. Even doing acts of service for others can be very healing.
If the expression on my face is any indication of how anxious that makes me feel, sharing my feelings with people, I mean, she must be able to read them loud and clear because she adds,
you can even start out just journaling your thoughts. Spend some time each day writing your feelings down.
A thought occurs to me. How did you move past the guilt?
My process was a little different than yours,
she says with an open expression on her face.
When Helen got me back to the States, she started me in some immediate and intensive therapy. I did a lot of the things I recommended to you just now, but what I was taught to practice on a daily basis was simple gratitude for the gift of survival.
The gift of survival? I ask, dumbfounded.
Yes, it's a gift. I was given the gift of not being shot, of not being raped, the gift of Helen finding and rescuing me. I was taught to focus on the positives rather than the negatives.
I just stare, wondering how that even works. She provides it to me in amazingly simple terms.
Tacker, You survived a plane crash. Few people do. MJ didn't. You were given the gift of life, and you should be grateful for it. If I were a betting woman, I'd say you've never once felt a moment of gratitude for living, have you?
Not once, I admit, without any hesitation.
I want you to work on that,
she replies with a smirk.
Consider it homework. In fact, I want you to start a journal. You need to write in it at least once a day. I also want you to end each day with a gratitude.
Hippy-dippy shit, I mutter. Nora rolls her eyes, making a grab for her tea. Does it ever go away? I ask, and her hand freezes just inches from her cup. She seems thoughtful, lips turning down slightly. When she shakes her head so minutely I almost can't see it, she confirms the worst.
No, not completely. Even all these years later, I'll occasionally have nightmares. Sometimes I'll think about what my sister went through and I'll get depressed, but I have techniques I practice, and I'm normally able to redirect my thoughts pretty easily.
Like what?
I focus on things that make me happy,
she says. Gratitude for being alive, I guess.
That,
she agrees with her ever-present smile. Taking her tea in hand, she manages a small sip before she continues.
But sometimes it's just doing something that causes me pleasure. A horse ride, a milkshake.
Seems simple enough, but for a man who has shied away from anything that remotely resembles happiness, it seems like a foreign concept. Sometimes when I look at pictures of MJ and me, I'll stare at myself as much as her. The smile on my face or the way a dimple in my right cheek popped when I laughed, and that person seems like a fake to me now. I don't even recognize him.
I have an idea,
Nora suggests. I blink, focusing with a tiny measure of trepidation. Her having an idea sounds very much like she wants me to do something outside my comfort zone.
Let's talk about something this week that you've been grateful for. You may not have even realized it happened.
When I walk out of Nora's house at the end of the session, I have to admit to feeling an incredibly unique sensation. I feel a tiny bit free, as if there's not a weight pushing me down. Nora might even translate that into hope, but I don't want to go that far. Raul pulls up on a gator as I'm walking down the porch steps. The back is loaded with two chainsaws. He nods in acknowledgement, and I return the gesture. The front door to the main house opens, and Nora comes trotting down the porch steps, putting on a pair of heavy work gloves. I nod at the chainsaws. Going to cut some stuff up?
Oh, yeah,
she replies with a laugh, rounding the front of the gator.
Too much work and not enough time on this ranch.
I'm going to the game tonight, so I need to head back to Phoenix, I say, wondering what the fuck I'm doing. But I could come back tomorrow and help. Nora's eyes briefly widen before she grins.
Okay, I'm not going to turn down free help. Just come on out when you can.
Okay, I reply. Nora waves and hops in the gator beside Raul. I watch as they roar away.
Chapter 10. Nora.
I've got that one,
Tacker says, as he nudges me aside to grab a fairly large section of an old mesquite Raul and I had cut down yesterday to make way for a new pasture. He places it carefully on the trailer, which we'd attached to the gator, and makes quick work of securing the pile down with bungee cords. It's our third load of the morning. We've been hauling them to the far end of the ranch. One day, I'll hopefully have the ability to haul it away from the ranch. For now, though, this will have to do. Burning it all isn't an option. Prohibited, actually. Although Tacker hadn't asked, He'd taken the driver's seat in the gator from the first load we moved. Must be a man thing, I'm thinking. But when he does it again, I take the passenger seat. At the pile of debris we'd cut, he also kept nudging me out of the way every time I try to pick up something heavy, until I finally had to tell him to back off, that I was more than capable of the work. I'd also pointed out he was the one lifting stuff with a wrist in a cast. Granted, he was able to easily grab the cut pieces with his good arm, but still, it was insulting in a way. For the most part, we've worked in silence today, which is fine. It's not a formal counseling session, but I'm always at the ready to talk if he wants. I'm not the type who can click my clients on and off outside formal office hours. But the short drive on the gator is an opportunity to engage in conversation, and I've gotten a good sense Tacker might need practice on how to re-engage with people since he's been so cut off from others for the past year. How was the game last night? I ask. I saw that the Vengeance won on the morning news. Tacker nods as we bump along the rough terrain, no road having been forged to where we're going.
It was a close game, but they pulled it out.
They? I ask curiously. It's your team, too. He shoots me a sharp look before it turns sheepish.
You're right. I should be using the term we.
It's easy to get disconnected when you're away from the action, I say. Once you're back on the ice with them again, it will seem like an old comfy hat.
It did feel good to be back in the arena again,
he admits, almost grudgingly. Laughing, I give him a small pop on his bicep with my fist. You're allowed to have happiness, Tacker. Remember, give yourself permission to feel grateful for things.
Yes, Doc,
he mutters, but I take heart in the way the corners of his lips curve upward. We reach our destination, unload the haul in a disproportionate effort as Tacker outlifts and outmoves me, and then head back in the gator with the now empty trailer. Head up to the main house, I say. It's almost lunchtime. I'll make us something to eat.
You don't have to.
He's quick to reply. I give him a slow smirk. Trust me, I have to. I feel guilty with how hard you've been working.
It's nothing,
he mutters. It's very much appreciated, I chide, not wanting him to dismiss his generosity at offering his time. Without volunteer help, not sure this place would survive. Tacker maneuvers the gator around the big barn, past my metal shack office, and over to the main house. As he brings it to a stop, he turns slightly in his seat.
Maybe I could get a couple of the guys from the team to come help on a day off. We could knock out the entire job in one day.
Surprised, I blink at him. Really? They'd do that?
I'm sure they would,
he replies, not sounding all that sure. I suspect that's because he's just not clear on what type of relationship he has with his team at this point. But I love he doesn't seem afraid to ask. That's a huge step.
Also, I'd like to invite someone else out to see the horses.
Sure, I reply easily, especially since he's offering all that muscle to help.
My teammate, Eric Dahlbeck, is dating this girl, Blue, and her brother, Billy, has cerebral palsy. He's wheelchair-bound, but I know he'd get a kick out of coming here to see the horses.
He's more than welcome, I say with excitement. Anyone from the team is. If you get a group out here, I'll fire up our barbecue pit at the barn and feed everyone. You could make it a fun get-together. Tacker seems distinctly uncomfortable at being thrust into the helm of a social event.
Well, I don't know.
Relax, I assure him, giving a soft pat to his forearm before moving out of the gator. Bending to see him, I wink. I've got you covered. I'll handle all the hosting. You just provide the backbone for the work, okay? I don't wait for him to answer, not wanting him to overthink things. The last thing I want is him to get inside his head and figure out a way to back out of this. Tacker needs connections. I mean, he genuinely needs this. And I know he's ready as well. After he gets out of the gator, he follows me inside the house, through the living area, and into the kitchen. I point at the round kitchen table. Take a load off while I whip us up something. Tacker sits heavily in one of the chairs. I pull a bottle of water out of the refrigerator for him, along with cold cuts and condiments. Can I ask you a personal question? I ask, from where I work at the counter by the window bordering the front porch. I opened it this morning because it's a nice day out and the fresh air smells good.
You're my therapist, he replies blandly. That's your job.
I glance at him over my shoulder. Yeah, but we're not technically in a session. I don't want to overstep my bounds.
Tacker shrugs. Go for it.
I return to my task, stacking turkey slices and ham on thick pieces of white bread. What's your family situation? Who do you have for a support system?
No one, really, he replies.
His answer makes my heart ache a bit.
Mom died when I was 13. My dad remarried pretty quickly, but I wasn't overly close to him. It's not a bad relationship, it's just non-existent.
Did he try to be there for you after the crash? I ask, which is a potentially sensitive question. Tacker doesn't answer right away before finally admitting,
Of course. I mean, he's my dad. He flew to Dallas, then stayed through MJ's funeral, but...
But then it was back to normal? I guess.
For him, yes. For me, nothing's been normal.
What about friends?
Funny you should ask,
he says, honest-to-goodness humor in his voice. It startles me so much I swivel to face him.
My best friend from Dallas just got traded to the Vengeance, Aaron Wilde. He showed up on my doorstep a few days ago.
Wonderful, I exclaim, knowing how helpful friends can be to someone like Tacker, who is trying to reestablish his life again. Tacker shrugs, letting his finger play with the salt shaker on the table.
I haven't been a good friend to him since the crash. Or rather, I wouldn't let him be a good friend to me.
It's terrifying to talk about your losses, I say, moving a few steps to reach the table. I merely put my hands on the back of the chair that's perpendicular to him. But if you avoid it due to your fears, then you avoid ever thinking about the person you lost. You risk losing all the good memories along with the bad. He nods, my words clearly striking something deep within him. But his tone sounds slightly flat.
I have to look at MJ's pictures more often than I used to. In my memories, her face is starting to lose focus.
I take a moment, wondering if I should wait to broach this until our next session. The Tacker is open and talking without hesitation. I hate to lose the moment. Leaning over, I put my forearms on the back of the chair, which brings my face more in line with his, so I'm not looming over him. Have you properly grieved for MJ? Surprised, Tacker frowns.
You mean, have I broken down and cried?
Quickly, I shake my head. Grieving is personal, and it doesn't necessarily look like any one thing. We commonly associate crying with it, but I'm talking about really allowing yourself to process your loss, whatever that looks like. Or do you think you've been so mired in anger and guilt that you haven't let the sadness in? He shakes his head, confusion crinkling his brow.
I don't know.
Straightening, I give him an encouraging smile. Think about it. Maybe journal about it tonight. But give yourself permission to feel sad, Tacker. You need to mourn, MJ. If you don't, you're missing a crucial step in healing. He swallows hard, muscle ticking in his jaw.
I'll put some thought to it.
Good, I reply brightly, deciding we need to move to lighter things, like food. Do me a favor, go out on the porch and ring the dinner triangle.
Are you serious?
He says, slowly rising from the table. Yep, Raoul should be heading this way for lunch, but he always loves ringing that damn triangle for me like I'm Pavlov's dog. I'm looking forward to doing it back to him. Tucker leaves, hits the porch, and reappears into my line of view through the window as I continue making lunch for us. I'm disappointed to see Raoul has already arrived and is at the side of the house, bent over and washing his hands at the faucet. Tucker sees him too, yet he still picks up the metal bar attached to the triangle by a piece of twine. There's no need to ring the bell, other than to startle Raoul and to fulfill my sense of payback. I can't help but laugh as Tucker does exactly that. He bangs the metal bar on the inside of the triangle, watching intently as Raoul skitters sideways away from the startling noise. Whipping around, he glares at Tucker, who innocently says, "Oops, sorry, didn't see you there." I grin, dropping my eyes to my work. But they continue to talk, so there's no stopping their voices, which carry to me. Popping my head up, I peek through the window screen when Raoul says,
"You're looking at Nora in a different way now."
He's moved to the edge of the porch, gazing up at Tucker. Since I'm not exactly sure what he means by that, my instinct is to say something so they both know I can hear everything. But then Raoul says,
"You're finally buying into what she says. And I like that, amigo."
I relax minutely as I realize Raoul is referring to nothing more than my philosophy and counseling. Not that he should be talking about any other way Tucker might be looking at me.
"She shared with me what happened to her in Kosovo,"
Tucker says, and I go tense again. Not that he's saying something he shouldn't, because Raoul knows everything, knows more about me than Tucker does, because he's had me cry on his shoulder many times when I was young and overly emotional about what had happened. I tense because I hadn't been sure just how much my story had helped Tucker. Raoul nods understandingly with a sage expression.
"You two share a connection. A common experience now." "It helps," Tucker admits. "More than I thought it would." "Respect it," Raoul advises. "And be grateful for it. She doesn't do this for everyone."
Tucker's head tilts.
"This?" "Invite people into her home. Tell them about her past."
Raoul pauses, staring off in the distance over the ranch. I know what he's thinking. He's grateful he's still here with me, that I gave him a job after I bought the ranch, because Raoul doesn't really have anyone else. His gaze moves to Tucker, and my eyes mist up a bit over the emotion in his voice.
"If you treat her right, Nora will be a friend to you for life. You'll never find someone more loyal or dedicated. Make sure you're worth it."
Those last words have an edge. Tucker smirks, his voice slightly teasing.
Yeah, I know. Or you'll whip my ass."
Raoul grins up at Tucker, making me realize he must have threatened him with the same thing before. I should admonish him for bullying my client, but I can't. I love him too much to do so. And Tucker seems to be okay with the jest. Raoul's booted feet hit the wooden porch. Then the front door opens, and both men enter the kitchen. When I glance at Raoul, he shoots me a short wink, which means he knows I was eavesdropping the whole time. I wink back at him.
Chapter 11. Tucker. This may have been one of the roughest weeks of my life, and one of the best at the same time. I stepped back onto the ice with the team, practicing with them each day. I still have the cast on, and I've not been cleared for gameplay, but fuck, it felt great. My teammates, every fucking one, hold nothing against me. There was no recrimination or blame for the way the team has faltered a bit over the last few weeks since my injury. Just genuine happiness I was back and incredible support of the silent variety, which I appreciate. Even Rafe Simmons, who had moved up from second line to first to take my spot, welcomed me back with a huge smile. Told me he was still going to play his ass off to keep the top spot once I was medically cleared, but that he realized it was a pipe dream. "You're the best center in the league, Tacker," he'd said with a light clap on my shoulder. "Our team needs you on the first line if we're going to take a solid run at the cup." As good as it was to be on the ice, it was frustrating as well. Obviously, my stick handling is clunky with the cast, and despite still hitting the gym during my recovery, my legs were easily gassed. I've got some major work to do to return to peak performance. I also saw Nora twice this week, having to shift to Tuesday and Thursday because of conflicts with practice. On her end, Nora shuffled her schedule to accommodate me, for which I'm grateful. She's incredibly busy and overworked. Since I hadn't been able to make our regular sessions, it would have been easy for her to refer me out to someone else. That's really not an option for me, so I made sure she knew how thankful I was. I wasn't sure if it was kosher or not, but I brought her a bouquet of flowers on Tuesday to let her know it was appreciated. No other therapist is going to work for me. Has nothing to do with the unique nature of this ranch or how the horses are used to get people to open up. I haven't touched a horse yet, thank fuck, but it has everything to do with Nora. Not only was a bond established when she told me about her past, letting me know I'm not alone in my feelings, but trust was formed when she shared with me first. Just knowing she has experienced every terrible feeling I have and still managed to overcome her pain gave me a renewed sense of purpose. For fuck's sake, the woman gives me hope. While it's been hard talking through my feelings this week, it had to be done. We spent our entire Tuesday session talking about MJ, not about the crash or how she died, but about what MJ meant to me. Nora encouraged me to spend that time reflecting on happier moments, had me really latch on and savor them. At one point, she even got me to laugh when she asked me to tell her the funniest thing MJ had ever done. I relayed a story about how she'd pranked me once by putting a fake spider in my car. After I laughed until my stomach hurt, I got incredibly sad and depressed, though. Didn't cry, but I went utterly quiet, feeling the weight of what I'd lost. Nora just let me be alone, in my silence. She waited until I was ready to talk again. Yeah, rough, but also incredibly helpful. By Thursday, I felt stronger. I didn't flinch when Nora had me talk about my grief. I got through it, which makes me wonder if our sessions are why I'm out furniture shopping right now. Have I moved into a headspace where I can think about establishing a real home? It has to be something like that because I fucking hate shopping. And yet, I follow the saleswoman around the store while she shows me living room and bedroom sets to choose from. It also makes me think I may perhaps need something a little bit better than the dumpy apartment I'm currently in. It's not exactly in the best neighborhood, and there's a lot of noise through the night with people yelling through paper-thin walls and parties going on. My phone chimes to alert me to a text, and I pull it out of my pocket. It's from Dax. "Think you can swing by my place to check on Reagan?" My heart rate speeds up a bit as I reply. "She okay?" "Yep, fine. Or so she says. But I'm a worrier. Can you check? Don't let her know I sent you." I snort, wondering if I ever acted that way about MJ. I can't recall going to that extent, but I certainly appreciate Dax's concern. Dax's wife, Reagan, holds a special place in my heart because of the way she'd once gotten me to open up to her. Last week, she landed in the hospital due to her exceedingly rare blood disease. She needed a transfusion, which righted her symptoms for the time being, and she was supposedly doing well. At least, that's what Dax reported during practice this week. But the team is now at an away game, so I imagine he might be a little freaked. It's her first day alone since she got out of the hospital earlier this week. "I'm on my way there now," I text. "I owe you big, buddy," he replies. I like Reagan a lot. She was a huge catalyst in pushing me toward admitting I really wanted to stay on this team. When she gave me a ride to the game last weekend, I had a good time with her. She's easy to talk to, witty, and also doesn't chatter up a storm. In other words, she didn't make me feel like I had to keep up a running conversation with her. At the game, she got down to business as a fan and player's wife, taking every single moment out there seriously. The girl knows the game, mostly because her late brother Lance was a professional player too. She knows the rules, the strategies, and the players. Reagan can more intelligently discuss the game on a deeper level than most people I know, so yeah, I had a great time with her. Which all means I don't mind running by to check on her. It's the least I can do for not only her, but also for Dax too. He's been gently pushing me in a supportive way over the last several weeks. At some point, I'm going to have to tell the dude I really appreciate it. The Uber driver stops perpendicular to the driveway. I'm confused by the two cars already parked there. If Reagan has company, I'll just do a quick peek to ensure she's fine before reporting to Dax. Rapping sharply on the door, I step back and wait. Mumbled voices sound faintly, and the door swings open, revealing a surprised Reagan.
"Hey,"
she says with a bright smile.
"What are you doing here?"
Remembering not to give away Dax's request to check up on her, I shrug. Just happened to be in the neighborhood and had time on my hands. Thought I'd say hello.
"That's awesome,"
she replies enthusiastically.
"Come in."
The wonderful smell of vanilla and chocolate hits my nose when I cross the threshold. As Reagan shuts the door, she raises her voice, sounding like she's trying to stifle a giggle.
"Look who's here, ladies! Now it's a real party!"
What the what? Jerking my head toward the kitchen, I see Brooke and Pepper both wearing aprons. Brooke has a large glass bowl supported in one arm, the other stirring something inside it. Brooke is Bishop's fiancée and Coach Perrone's daughter. Pepper is Legend's fiancée. I suspect the only reason Blue, Eric's girlfriend, isn't here is because she's a flight attendant on the team plane, which means she travels with them.
"We're having a cookie baking party,"
Reagan says, latching onto my arm and pulling me into the kitchen.
"You can help."
Trying to backpedal, I throw my thumb over my shoulder toward the door. Actually, I have to—"
"Hey, Tacker!"
Brooke chirps. The next thing I know, Pepper wraps an apron around my waist and spins me so Reagan can tie it in the back. I really can't stay," I stutter, totally horrified I'd crashed a women's party, which is the last place in the world I want to be.
"Sure you can,"
Reagan laughs, tugging me over to the counter.
"You said you had time on your hands. We're baking cookies for Pepper's church. It's for charity, so it's good for your soul. Plus, we get to eat cookies at the same time,"
Brooke says with a grin.
"Why wouldn't you want to stay is the real question."
Fuck. I sigh heavily, resigned to stay for 10 minutes at the most. Then I can report to Dax that his woman is more than fine, and I'm never doing another favor for him again. 2 hours later. "Pay attention to what you're doing," I order Pepper, gesturing to the dough she's dropping onto the cookie sheet. They're not uniform in size. Reagan snorts from her perch at the kitchen sink where she's washing what seems like a never-ending supply of dirty bowls.
Admit it.
Brooke teases from her seat at the kitchen table. Apparently, she'd gotten tired of making cookies and had popped open a bottle of wine. She's currently on her second glass.
We're fun to hang out with.
Sadly, I have to admit it's true. Only because you ladies know hockey and other sports and didn't discuss PMS or the Kardashians. Airily, Brooke waves her wine glass.
We'd already covered those subjects before you got here.
Pepper pulls a batch of chocolate chip cookies from the oven, and my stomach rolls a bit. I've eaten more than my fair share, and I feel like I need another workout. She puts three on a small plate, brings them to the table, and sets it in front of me. Fuck, I should decline, but they're too good. I reach out and nab a hot one, moving it from hand to hand as it cools. I glance up at Pepper, noting the healthy color of her skin and the smile in her eyes as she watches me.
How are you feeling? Recovery going good?
Her brow lifts in surprise, even though I've been engaging with all the women in constant conversation since I got here. I guess it's still a bit shocking to them that I actually know how to talk.
I'm doing really good,
she says, glancing at the engagement ring on her finger with a soft smile. Legend had given it to her in the hospital after she'd been shot by his ex-girlfriend. It scared the fuck out of him, the prospect of Pepper dying. I remember that feeling all too well, that same sick, twisted pain deep in the pit of my stomach I'd felt after the crash when I had to sit there for hours and watch MJ die beside me. A rush of panic hits me, the urge to lurch out of my chair and run for the door overwhelming. Then Nora's words filter in through the buzzing in my ears.
Take a deep breath, Tacker. Let it fill your lungs, expand your belly. Hold it for 3, 2, 1. And let it out slowly.
She'd done that hippy-dippy shit on me Thursday at the end of our session, wanted to teach me a few meditation techniques, then had encouraged me to use it whenever I felt a negative emotion. I suck in air through my nose, trying to be unobtrusive in what I'm doing, but the closing of my eyes probably gives it away. There's total silence around me as I fill my lungs, my stomach, then hold the breath and let it out. I do it again, slowly, as Nora urged, and then once more for good measure. When I open my eyes, Brooke and Reagan are at the sink, chatting away, but Pepper watches me with sympathy. My face flushes, but I hold her gaze. Her hand comes to my shoulder, and she gives me a short squeeze.
I meditate too. It really helps, especially if I wake up from a nightmare.
From when you were shot? I ask. She nods, adding in a matter-of-fact tone.
It also helps to practice throughout the day, just a few times, whether you need it or not.
Okay, I reply, sort of dumbly. It's hard to believe that in just a week I've managed to reconnect with my teammates and my best friend, opened up in therapy in ways I never thought I would, and attended a girls-only party to bake cookies, where I've gotten advice on how to meditate. My world has turned fucking upside down. A chime from my phone distracts me. I nab it from the counter, setting the cookie I've yet to eat back on the plate. It's a text from Dax.
Have you been by the house yet? How's Reagan?
Suspicious now, I glance around the kitchen at the women, realizing this was a setup. Dax knew damn well this was going on, and he'd sent me right into the midst of this gaggle of female hormones.
I don't hesitate, typing back quickly. She's great. In fact, I convinced her to divorce you and marry me.
Not funny, dude,
he replies. Laughing, I tuck my phone away, not bothering to respond. My silence will irritate the shit out of him, which he deserves.
Chapter 12. Nora. I'm waiting for Tacker by the paddock closest to the long driveway off the main road to the ranch. I want to work with Starlight today, so I'm planning to intercept him. I'm surprised when he pulls in, driving what looks to be a sparkling new truck. He sees me and I wave, pointing for him to park alongside the paddock. Tacker exits his truck and rounds the front to meet me. I'm pleased to see an easy smile on his face. He's already such a different person in just a few short weeks. He has miles to go, but he absolutely made it over a major hump. You're driving, I note, nodding toward the truck. He glances at it.
Yeah. My attorney advised me to plead to a careless and reckless. I have to take a substance abuse and safe driving course, but I managed to get my driving privileges back.
That's great, I say, starting toward the paddock gate. Tacker follows. We're going to work out here today.
With a horse?
He asks, his tone not quite fearful, but not happy either. No, with a two-headed pig, I tease with a laugh.
Strangely, I'd be more comfortable with that, he mutters.
With perfect timing, Raoul comes out of the barn, holding Starlight by her lead. She plods placidly along behind him. I open the gate, taking Starlight from Raoul, who nods at Tacker in greeting.
What are you up to today?
Tacker asks in greeting.
More work than daylight time,
Raoul replies in his age-roughened voice.
Going to clear some brush in the back pasture. But I've got the team coming out tomorrow, Tacker says,
and I have to smile over the concern in his voice. After each of his last few sessions with me, Tacker stayed to help Raoul with some of the manual labor around the ranch. They've developed an easygoing friendship.
There's more work than a hockey team can do in one day, Raoul points out. Then we'll come back out on another day,
Tacker counters. Raoul winks.
Stop talking like that. Nora will fire me if she figures out she can get all these done by volunteers for free.
As if, I exclaim. You're irreplaceable, you old fart, and you know it. Tacker and Raoul grin at each other. Enough of the small talk, I order the men. Tacker and I have work to do, just like you, Raoul. Raoul takes his leave of the paddock, and soon we hear the gator roaring off into the distance. I turn to face Tacker, stroking Starlight on her muzzle. You ready?
He shrugs. I guess.
Come closer, I tell him, and he takes two tentative steps. Just stroke her here, like me for a bit. He does as I ask, this time with no hesitation. Starlight holds perfectly still as Tacker's fingers on his good hand rub along the length of her face. Take the lead, I say, handing over the rope, but keep stroking her. His casted hand takes the rope, holding it lightly. Starlight is so gentle that I have no problems with him controlling my horse with a broken wrist. Now, just walk her around the arena, I say. Keep her on your right. Again, Tacker does what I ask without any complaint or question as to why I'm asking him to, and I'm doing it for no other reason than to just give him a little bit of practice and experience with a horse. Plus, for what I plan to talk about today, I want him to have something else to focus on other than me. Tacker has hit a lot of milestones over the past 2 weeks in therapy with me. I can take some of the credit, but honestly, he has a lot of external factors that have been playing well into his healing. He's been hanging some with Aaron, along with his other teammates. I watch as Tacker leads Starlight around a few loops before calling them to me. After I take the lead from him, I tie it to the top rail of the fence and instruct, "Go to her side." Tacker does, and I walk around her, taking up post on her opposite side, so we're staring at each other over her back. Just put your hands on her, anywhere. You can stroke her or just hold them there. You can touch her anywhere you want. I just want you to get used to her, so you can see she's super sweet and doesn't mind you doing it.
What's the point of this?
He asks, actually taking a lock of Starlight's blonde mane in his hand and running his fingers down the length. Change of scenery, distraction, and plus, I want to get you over your fear of horses. That's just a personal goal of mine.
I'm not afraid, he says, his eyes coming to mine. I just don't have experience with them. They're unpredictable.
Not all are, I say. But like any animals, there are some that aren't well trained.
Makes sense, I guess.
Are you excited about next week? I ask, referring to the fact he's going to play in his first game on Tuesday. They have back-to-back away games next week. He's been doing so well in practice this week that his coach told him he's going back onto the first line. Since I've met Tacker, I've never seen him smile so broadly. It's almost as if this news gave him a new burst of energy, and he seems to be eagerly confronting most any topic in our sessions.
I'm dreaming every night of getting back in the game, he says with a chuckle, returning his attention to Starlight's mane.
Both hands work at it as he talks.
Like vivid, technicolor dreams. I can feel the chill of the ice and the screams of fans. And in all my dreams, I score every goal.
I laugh, running a hand over Starlight's back. That's awesome.
It's part of my life, he says quietly, his eyes coming to mine. I don't think I realized that until I was cut loose from it. Then given this chance to come back, it's like I have a new appreciation.
It's a good sign in your journey, I point out. It's the gratitude we were talking about, where you can take joy in the things you have. He nods, fingers moving busily. Following his movement, I laugh when I see he's actually braided a section of her hair. Didn't know you were so accomplished with hair, I say. His lips curl up, his voice going soft.
I used to braid MJ's hair. Weird, huh?
Not at all, I say. Very intimate. Again, his gaze moves to me and he swallows hard.
Now's the time to talk about it, right?
I had hoped we would. I think you're ready. We're talking about the actual crash and what happened after. It's a subject he steered me far away from over the last 2 weeks. But because he's made such amazing strides, I know he can do it. I honestly think he needs to do it. Needs to make it over that final big hurdle of the most painful thing to talk about. To my surprise, Tacker puts his forearms on Starlight's back, one on top of the other, then lowers his head until his chin rests on them. He's leaning slightly against the horse, and the sunlight makes the differentiation of browns, golds, and green in his eyes sparkle.
I don't remember the crash. For a few moments, I couldn't even tell if we were going up or down, because I was so disoriented. At some point, we were upside down, but that's really all I know. The crash investigators say I'd managed to get it upright again, and that the treetop sort of slowed us down a bit. But I pretty much blacked out the actual impact.
His voice isn't quite flat, but it is a little detached. A safety mechanism. What's the next thing you remember? I ask.
Pain, he replies. In my back. A piece of the wreckage had sliced diagonally across my back, which is what woke me up. I remember reaching back, my hand coming away with blood all over it. The plane remained pretty much intact, or at least the cockpit area had. Except.
His voice trails off. Except. I prod. Tacker blinks a few times, then straightens. He doesn't bolt, but merely starts playing with Starlight's mane again. His fingers work at braiding another long piece as he talks.
Except a huge tree branch had come through the cockpit windshield at a downward angle, hitting MJ in the lower stomach and pelvis. I don't say a word, but my stomach cramps with pain over what it must have been like for him to see that, what it must have been like for her to feel that.
He
says, his voice cracking slightly.
She was, unconscious at that point. I actually thought she was dead when I figured out what had happened and saw all the blood. I was in shock and couldn't tear my eyes away, unsure what to do. When I finally snapped out of it, I tried to move, but my legs were pinned in by the wreckage. Then the radio sort of crackled and startled me.
Were you able to call for help? I ask, giving him a moment to distance himself from the horror.
Yeah, they had me on radar still. Said help was on the way, but I was in a pretty remote area. It took a few hours.
And what did you do during that time?
Realized MJ wasn't dead,
he replies bitterly, his eyes still locked on his fingers that diligently work at Starlight's mane.
Had reached out to her with my hand. Wanted to just touch her. And when I did, she sort of moaned.
I can't even imagine, I murmur, which causes his attention to come to me.
You can, though,
he replies.
You watched people you love die right in front of you.
Not for hours, I say. He shrugs, but it's a pitiful attempt to diminish the horror.
She was in so much pain,
Tacker says, his voice cracking even more.
And she was lucid through some of it. She'd wake up, then pass out again. But the times when she was awake, she was very much aware of what was happening to her.
What were you feeling, Tacker? I ask.
Helpless, he says. Out of fucking control. I've never felt so worthless in my life.
It wasn't your fault, I remind him.
She didn't know that,
he croaks, and tears fill his eyes.
I mean, she didn't understand what had happened other than I'd crashed that plane. As far as she knew, I'd killed her.
I don't know, MJ, other than through the memories Tacker has shared over the last few weeks. But what I've gleaned is she was a kind woman who loved him. In a million years, I can't imagine her ever laying blame on his doorstep. So I go out on a short limb, attempting to focus his attention on that. Did she hold you responsible? Did she say that to you? He shakes his head hard, and his eyes squeeze shut, releasing a stream of tears. I watch as they flow down his cheeks, his hands gripping into Starlight's mane. She holds still, a patient support system for his pain.
She'd never do that,
he finally says, opening his eyes, but not meeting mine. He uses one hand to dash the tears away. Then you need to stop doing it to yourself, I remind him. Tacker gives a bark of a humorless laugh.
I'd almost have rather had a recrimination.
Tilting my head, I reach across Starlight's back and take his good hand in mine. I squeeze it hard to get his attention. Why? Why would you have rather had that?
Because, he croaks.
And then Tacker completely loses it. A sharp sob breaks free, followed by a torrent of tears. Laying his head down on Starlight's back, he cries. Loud, racking sobs interspersed with piteous moaning. He's in so much pain. But all I can do is hold tightly to his hand and trust Starlight will support his weight while he needs it. Tacker pours it out, his chest heaving with the effort. I quietly watch, taking note that my own body is reacting. Tears slip out of my eyes, and my chest aches so badly that my heart feels shredded for him. I had not anticipated this today, but I don't stop it. He needs it. To him, his breakdown might have felt like an eternity. In truth, though, it wasn't more than a few moments. Eventually, he quiets, except for some long, shuddering breaths he sucks in and lets out. Over and over again, he moves into the deep breathing techniques I'd taught him. On his own, he brings himself back under control. Tacker lifts his head. Rather than be embarrassed by his purging of emotion, he looks me dead in the eyes. It's a sign of trust that takes my breath away.
MJ spent all her time left on this earth telling me how I needed to go on. That she wanted me to continue to live life and not get lost in my grief. Told me she wanted me to get married one day, wanted me to have lots of children, and wanted me to remember her fondly, and I swear, Nora.
He pauses, sucks in a breath, and tries to temper the anger in his voice.
I swear, he continues in a low voice, that part of me hated her for doing that to me.
For doing what? I press, because this is critical. That muscle in the corner of his jaw ticks, and his voice rumbles with emotion.
For dying graciously, trying to absolve me of guilt, for preparing me for a life without her. She died a movie death. I mean, who does that shit in real life?
MJ did, I say simply, and it's a sign of how beautiful her soul was. He grunts and mutters a curse under his breath, his gaze shooting off to the side. You'd have done the same, I say, and his anguished eyes search mine. I lift my chin. You absolutely would have done the same for her if the positions were reversed. He can't argue with me. He knows I'm right. It's a gift, Tacker, I say. She gave you an amazing gift, and you need to accept it as such. Although his lips are pressed flat, I can see him grinding his teeth. He's had enough. Come on, I suggest, pulling my hand gently from his. Let's go groom Starlight, and you can tell me all about the team practice yesterday. You were back on the first line, right? Our counseling sessions haven't been all gloom and doom. I've spent some of each hour with him learning about his job and the importance of it within the framework of his life.
Yeah,
he says. Pulling the lead free of the rail, I hand it to him so he can lead the horse to the barn.
We were a little rusty, for sure, but by the end of the practice, we were totally back in sync.
And you get your cast off tomorrow? I ask. He nods as I fall into pace beside him.
Supposedly. The plan is to move me to a splint for a few weeks if it's healing right, but I'll have more mobility.
We chat about hockey all the way back to the barn. Some of the horses pop their heads out to say hello. There are no other appointments this afternoon, which is how I knew it was the right time to press Tacker into working with Starlight and talking about MJ's death. When I reach her stall, Tacker asks,
How would you and Raoul like to come to a game soon?
A surprising excitement fills me, and I smile. Really? I've never even seen a game on TV.
Really, he says, with a return one. I'd love to have you two come and watch me.
Then yes, I accept on behalf of us both. Tacker's eyes are bright, the pain receding. He merely nods, his lips curved up as he leads Starlight into the stall. Chapter 13. Nora. The stream of cars that bounced down our gravel driveway mid-morning was unending. Tacker managed to bring almost the entire team, with the exception of a few of the guys who had long-standing plans that couldn't be canceled. They all stepped out, muscled and dressed for some hard work. I was almost giddy from the prospect, and not because of the muscles, but because I could actually make a dent in the project that would have taken us months to do on our own. I could barely talk when Tacker strode over to me, sweeping his arm out.
Your working party has arrived.
My eyes darted around, taking in the sheer amount of people he'd brought. Focusing on him, I try to come up with the right words. Then I notice his wrist. Your cast. I thought you were getting it off early this morning. Tacker shook his head, lips pressed flat.
Doc said it needs another 2 weeks.
But you were ready to play next week, I said worriedly, knowing how excited he'd been.
Oh, don't you worry about that, he replied with a sly grin. I'm playing with or without the cast.
You can do that?
Of course I can.
He'd laughed, then given me a wink.
Now I've got work to do, so excuse me.
And it wasn't just players Tacker had brought. I was stunned when the Vengeance's coach, Claude Perron, introduced himself to me along with Christian Rutherford, the general manager. There were other folks from the management end, too. Several of the wives and girlfriends also came, some dressed to haul brush and timber, while others came bearing loads of food. I had offered to barbecue for the crew, but Tacker had forbidden me from buying anything. He told me he'd handle everything, and that all I needed to do was make sure there was a fresh propane tank in the grill. While introductions were being made and work parties were organized, I took a moment to observe Tacker and how he interacted with others. I was pleased to see that while he looked a little out of his element, he didn't shy away from the team as a whole. He did tend to congregate with a core group of mates, whom he introduced me to as his first line, a term I'd become familiar with as we'd often talked about the game of hockey in our sessions. The first line was the best line, the most skilled competitors on a team. Bishop, the captain and right winger. Dax, left winger. Legend, the team's goalie and the assistant captain. The two defensemen, Eric and his best friend, Aaron Wilde. Tacker was the center, the nucleus who held them all together. I can't even imagine how out of sync they had been when they'd lost him. The team as a whole and his line. But watching them today, I could tell they were going to pull back together quickly. There was a bond there that couldn't be broken by Tacker's demons. The most shocking arrival of all had come not long after the Vengeance volunteers had dispersed to the different areas of the ranch, where they'd be clearing and hauling. A luxury car pulled up, followed by a tractor trailer, carrying an actual tractor on its flatbed. A sparkling brand new tractor that could provide the necessary muscle for us to blow through the heavy-duty chores on the ranch. The man who stepped out of the luxury vehicle was incredibly handsome, and while he was wearing jeans and a t-shirt, he seemed like he'd be more comfortable in a designer three-piece suit. Eric's girlfriend, Blue, introduced us. Dominic Carlson, the freaking owner of the Arizona Vengeance. Merely telling me he appreciated all the help I'd given Tacker, he'd handed over the keys to the tractor. With no other fanfare, he wandered off to find one of the working parties to put his own nice muscles to work. The best part of the day, by far, had been hanging with Blue